Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 400, recorded on Sunday, November 21st, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Rachel, welcome back to new episodes. We're getting it started right with episode 400, a big one. Another anniversary that recently passed that we didn't acknowledge back in September was the 10th anniversary of the start of Arsenal for Democracy. Obviously, we've had a really exciting couple of years on the show, especially since we did that Standard Oil series in the spring of 2020. And we are continuing that this episode. We are continuing our historical materialist analysis of the United States with another look back, as we've done many times this year, at the year 1921. And specifically, we're going to be talking about November 23rd, 1921, the signing of the Promotion of the Welfare and Hygiene of Maternity and Infancy Act, which is more commonly known as the Shepard-Towner Act. This represented essentially the, this is quoting now from the Wikipedia summary, the first venture of the federal government into Social Security legislation and the first major legislation that came into exist after the full enfranchisement of white women, which played an important role in the medicalization of pregnancy and childbirth, the decrease in infant mortality rates, and the expansion of federal welfare legislation in the 20th century United States. Now, previously, I know we had talked some last year on episode 320 about some of the, you know, things that happened after the ratification of the 19th Amendment, granting at least some women the right to vote in federal elections. This was obviously one of the major priorities that came out of that initial wave of attempting to use that new power to influence policy at the federal level. However, it might be a bit of an exaggeration, as I think we'll discuss, to overplay how much of a major piece of legislation this was. It was important, it was influential, but it was relatively short-lived, and the amount of money that we're talking about was relatively small as well. So, Rachel, I guess let's get right into it. What exactly was the Shepard-Towner Act? What was it attempting to accomplish in this 1920s period that it existed for, and it only existed during the 1920s?
Yeah, so at this time, the U.S. was experiencing really just appalling maternal and infant mortality rates. In 1918, it ranked 17th in maternal and 11th in infant mortality rates. So the Children's Bureau, which was established in 1909, did a study on this, and they found a correlation between poverty and the mortality rate. So for families earning less than $450 annually, one baby in six died within the first year. For the income range of $650 to $850 annually, the rate was 1 in 10. And for those earning about $1,250 annually, the rate was 1 in 16. So just really bad rates. There was obviously a clear link between poverty and whether your children were able to survive the first year. And the studies also found that 80% of America's expectant mothers received no advice or trained care. So at this time, there wasn't a lot of affluent people, and there also wasn't a lot of like highly trained and skilled physicians in the country. So most mothers had unattended births, or they were attended by a midwife. So just very casualized maternal care at this time. So what the Shepard-Towner Act, also known as the Welfare and Hygiene of Maternity and Infancy Act really attempted to do was kind of reach down into the root causes of infant and maternal mortality and really ameliorate the situation. So one aspect of the act led to the creation of 3,000 child and maternal health care centers. Many of these were concentrated in rural areas during the 8 years it was in effect. So what they attempted to do was professionalize or license the midwives, kind of teach them more standardized healthcare methods, teach them about hygiene and how to care for mothers and their babies. So how this worked was there were block grants that were distributed to the states, and then the states were really in charge of running these programs to teach and train these midwives. The Children's Bureau was able to kind of regulate the program, but it really was operated through the state. So like I said, they were teaching the use of sterile techniques, the use of silver nitrate eye drops to prevent gonococcal blindness, and other standardized methods. And they also provided information to birthing mothers, kind of a what to expect while you're expecting situation. Just kind of reaching both the mothers and the midwives where they were at, and helping inform them as to the process of childbirth. So these midwives were kind of in opposition to more professionalized doctors. The doctors saw midwives as dirty, superstitious, just kind of ignorant, unprofessional. And the public health workers did kind of admire the skills of the midwives, but they also often had racist attitudes and kind of contempt for the cultural practices and traditions towards these majority Black and immigrant midwives. It wasn't all bad. Some midwives really appreciated the knowledge that they were learning in these classes from the public health workers, and some of the workers did value the skills of the midwives. Despite the lack of the formal training, they were informed on like massage and like turning the baby to make sure there weren't breech births, different birthing positions that helped facilitate an easier delivery. So they kind of did value the knowledge that each other had, but there was also a lot of conflict as well. The midwives did kind of see the health workers as kind of meddling, and also they feared the workers' powers to like yank their licenses or forbid them from practicing their midwifery. So there was quite a bit of conflict as well. The public health workers also faced opposition from conservative groups who saw them as like meddling with families, meddling with more private healthcare, and trying to replace the sphere of this private healthcare with the state, and also violating the principle of states' rights. Despite the rather modest provisions of the law, I mean, the states were operating these programs, so they weren't actually really overstepping, but the conservative groups really saw it that way. There was also a faction of conservatives that thought that medicine should be the sole domain of skilled male doctors rather than women who learn through tradition and kind of passing down of information from generation to generation. So by the time the act was repealed, only 15% of births were attended by a midwife, mainly among poor Southern Black women. A doctor wasn't always a good alternative or even an affordable alternative to a midwife. Doctor attended births were definitely way more expensive than most families could afford, especially in those rural and poor areas. And there were horror stories of families rendered destitute after a doctor sued them for fees owed after a birth. So without a midwife, the only alternative was an unattended birth, which was quite common at the time. And so hence the really high, infant and maternal mortality rates. So there really was a lot of change happening at this time, kind of a more formalization of medicine, really shifting from kind of the home as the sphere of medicine into more of like a hospital, formalized hospital sphere of healthcare.
And we'll get back to that in just a few minutes, as I think this one reason that we're talking about this, not just because it's the centennial of this act, but also because this is sort of indicative of a number of other trends happening in healthcare at this time period in the 1920s and shortly thereafter. As a reminder, as always, we will have a PDF up at arsenalfordemocracy.com with this episode that will go over some of the links and sources that we used. For example, articles from the Journal of American History, the Journal of Social History. There was a number of other specific studies on sort of the implementation, the financing structure, and the limitations of this act and so forth, which Cambridge University had posted online from a number of different sources, including the Journal of Economic History and the Journal of Policy History. But let's talk a little bit about the opposition to this legislation, which is a major factor in why, although it was, you know, signed into law in 1921 under the Harding administration, and it was a bipartisan bill, by 1929 it had expired. So the American Medical Association, frequently the villains of public health policy history in the United States, especially in the 20th and 21st century, they lobbied for the expiration of the Sheppard-Towner Act because of their constant terror over creeping socialism, the possibility that more women were being given a role in health policy and formalized medical care, and so on. One of the articles that Rachel looked at said that the AMA first broke away from progressivism over the issue of compulsory health insurance, and after its House of Delegates condemned health insurance in 1920, the association soon came to see Sheppard-Towner Act as only another form of the same thing, which is a little bit strange, as this didn't really seem to me to be an insurance program. It really seemed to be more of a health centers program and an educational and training program, especially given the limited scope. Was that your impression as well, Rachel?
Yeah, it seemed like more like of an outreach program than anything actually really providing healthcare directly to patients in any sort of way. It was just, yeah, more public health outreach.
And another source of opposition to the Sheppard-Towner Act throughout the 1920s was reactionary anti-communist women's groups who existed explicitly to counter women's groups that had pushed for its passage in the first place. So similarly to, you know, later on anti-feminist women's groups that were against the Equal Rights Amendment, this is sort of the contemporary version of that in the 1920s, which is the, you know, the anti-suffrage women's groups, the conservative women's groups, essentially, who were opposing things like Sheppard-Towner Act for all of the same ideological reasons that men, conservative men, would be opposing it, right? That this is an overreach of the state. This is, you know, a violation of states' rights. This is an interference in, you know, this the family and the home life and so forth. The legislation was renewed, initially, but then was allowed to expire ultimately in 1929. Some of its provisions were revived a few years later in 1935 as part of the new Social Security Act in Title V, which is Maternal and Child Health Services Block Grant. The United States, of course, as listeners of this show will be well aware, has a pretty wild culture of openly insisting that any attempt to make life better, safer, and healthier is a communist plot to destroy the family. And of course, this legislation was coming into existence shortly after the first Red Scare, and many of the people involved in the first Red Scare were heavily involved in trying to spike this by 1929. Utah's Democratic Senator William H. King said the legislation was supported by, quote, neurotic women, social workers who obtained pathological satisfaction in interfering with the affairs of other people, and Bolsheviks who did not care for the family and its perpetuity. End quote. Senator King was, of course, one of the maniacs on the special Senate committee dealing with alleged pro-German and Bolshevik activities within the United States during and shortly after World War I, which was largely made up and which we discussed at length in our episode on the American Protective League earlier this year in 2021. Rachel, I know you wanted to talk a little bit briefly about some of those anti-suffrage conservative women's groups as well that were really honing in on trying to kill Sheppard-Towner after it was passed into law.
Yeah, Mary Kilbreth, who was a leading anti-suffragist at the time, wrote Harding, the president who signed the bill, a six-page letter which condemned his signing of the bill. Quote, "It is not brought forward by the combined wisdom of all Americans but by the propaganda of a self-interested bureau associated with the feminist bloc. There are many loyal American men and women, she warned, who believe that this bill, inspired by foreign experiments in communism and backed by the radical forces in this country, strikes at the heart of our American civilization. So just really swinging for the fences here in the face of a pretty milquetoast bill. Didn't really do all the things that they promised, that the antis promised it was attempting to do.
Exactly. And let's talk a little bit about that. So to give you a sense of the scale here, the annual appropriations, at least as far as we were able to find, for the Sheppard-Towner Act programs while they existed, were around $1.2 to $1.4 million in 1921 dollars. If you convert that to more current dollars, and I'm not using 2021 dollars just because of the current, you know, whatever's going on with whether or not there's inflation, I use 2019 just to get, you know, a pre-pandemic benchmark. That would be equivalent to about $17 to $21 million being spent on this per year in that period of about 1922 to 1929 when the legislation expired. Just $5,000 plus a proportional population bonus was block granted to state governments one by one. And the state governments themselves had to match the federal dollars. You can probably immediately see what the problem is going to be here. The Children's Bureau federal agency administered this program nationally, but they only provided advice and recommendations to the state governments on implementation. The Bureau could not even collect its own data across the country and instead attempted to rely on state-submitted data, which varied in quality and quantity. The realization of that specific problem, which had obvious consequences both on the policy efficacy and the political defense of the law, ended up profoundly influencing the architects of the New Deal a few years later. They would insist, by contrast, on much stronger federal oversight and data collection of all new assistance programs, including Social Security and including specifically that provision on maternal and, you know, child health outcomes. And that was according to one of the research sources, the research paper sources that I found on Sheppard-Towner. And in fact, some states never even participated at all in Sheppard-Towner. They might not be the ones you're expecting, though. These included Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Illinois. I think one can't help but be reminded at this point in the more recent context of the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansions, right? Many states did not expand Medicaid because they didn't have to, essentially. That was how the Supreme Court interpreted the law. Even though that they were going to get a bunch of money from the federal government, because they would have had to match it on their own, they were allowed to opt out. And so we seem to see a similar effect happening here. And that means that some people were not receiving any benefit from this program. Although some of the researchers argue that that's partly because some of those states maybe had more robust systems already in place themselves and didn't really feel like they needed the federal assistance. But it's kind of hard to gauge that because, again, you get these resistances for other reasons. Once the law ended in 1929, and this was particularly interesting to me, states didn't really continue to fund these kind of programs on their own. States that already had strong public health systems before 1921 kept going with that, and states that had not basically simply gave up, at least on average. And that lasted, again, in this interim period between 1929 and Social Security being enacted in 1935. In other words, there wasn't a lasting boom in maternal health investment from the push to appeal to the women's vote, even in states where women were a brand new voting bloc in non-federal elections. So the upshot of this is this was a short-lived program, relatively small in scope and funding, that was allowed to expire and didn't seem to have much in the way of sort of lingering effects from states deciding to keep going with this on their own, which is, of course, unfortunate. Rachel, you had another citation from one of those other research papers on this as well.
Yeah, just some hard numbers. So in reviewing the work under Sheppard-Towner, the Children's Bureau reported for the 7 years that it conducted 183,252 health conferences and established 2,978 permanent centers of prenatal care. Visiting nurses made 3,131,996 home visits, and 22,020,489 pieces of literature had been distributed. In the final 4 years, more than 4 million infants and 700,000 expectant mothers had been reached. The infant death rate in 1921 was 75 per 1,000 live births, and the year under Shepherd Towner saw it fall to 64 per 1,000. The maternal death rate was reduced from 67 and 3/10 per 1,000 in 1921 to 62 and 3/10 in 1927, despite the fact that the general death rate of all people had risen slightly for the same period. So despite the fact that they really didn't get much by way of resources, they were able to reduce maternal and infant death rates to a fairly significant degree, which is pretty encouraging and kind of is baffling that they didn't, that most states didn't continue this public health outreach because it was so effective.
Yeah, that's the horrifying thing about this. Despite what a modest piece of legislation this was, despite what a significant impact it had during the years that it existed, it mostly only served to be an influence on the Social Security and New Deal architects on what not to do in the future, which obviously that's helpful. But think about all the people that the women and children that died during that intervening period solely out of basically spite from jealous doctors, anti-communist reactionaries, conservative women, and this other sort of, you know, anybody else in this sort of hodgepodge coalition of, you know, dead-eyed psychos that didn't really care whether people lived or died as long as some abstract notion of liberty and sort of professionalism was guarded. So this brings us back around to the point that you were bringing up earlier, and which I promised we would get back into, which is sort of examining this piece of legislation in the 1920s in the broader context of what was going on with what we would now consider to be the healthcare field at the time. Now, you've already alluded to or described some of the push here to sort of license and professionalize midwives, but there were also a lot of people pushing for only doctors to have this role and potentially even to move away from home births and toward hospital births. And this would have represented a profound shift, obviously, for most Americans, but it also is indicative, as I said earlier, of changes that were happening in the bigger picture on healthcare. So some of this is a little bit of a tangent, but some of it I think you'll see is pretty clearly related to this. And so I wanted you, Rachel, to talk a little bit about kind of the big picture here on healthcare in this country during this transitional period between you know, World War I and World War II, but especially before the New Deal era.
Right. So it's important to remember in this discussion of 1920 social legislation targeting maternal and infant health that hospitals were only just starting to be recognizable in their modern form, and basics like penicillin weren't even discovered until 1928, and hospital stay health insurance didn't exist until 1929. These things were proliferate during the 1930s and 1940s, but in the 1920s, when this legislation was implemented and repealed, birth would have been viewed as a home process, not a medical procedure requiring hospitalization. Yet at the same time, there would have been a big push beginning right around this time to make it exactly that, despite the health risks inherent in these hospitals. These political and economic forces with bad timing certainly helped kill this first attempt at federal social welfare legislation. It also made it difficult to make any headway on the health outcomes it hoped to improve, because there was not enough official respect and understanding for non-medical birthing practices, traditions, and specialists then prevalent. So the modern hospital as it is conceived of today really started taking shape in the 1860s. These hospitals had modern specialized departments and professionalized nursing staffs. What really kind of helped spur this push is the economic expansion and the urbanization of the population during the Second Industrial Revolution, which led to these large, expansive hospitals. Along with the developments of new techniques and knowledge of aseptic practices, you wouldn't want to catch sepsis and die, which was actually a fairly common outcome if you had to have any like surgical procedure done. And also at this time, medical care was shifting away from the home and kind of these home practices that doctors were working out of and into these hospitals. And physicians were becoming more professionalized and moving into specialty practices. And along with this move, healthcare costs started to rise. Before the 1920s, hospitals operated without much money. Physicians donated their time, and nursing and other staff costs were low. So as these more complicated medical procedures became widespread, more surgeries were happening. And so at this time, surgeons and other specialists began getting paid for their time and expertise. And also there was the rise of professionalized nurses, They had to get certified and licensed, and so their wages went up as well. At this time, large hospitals began affiliating with universities and medical schools to kind of help offset these rising healthcare costs. And it, at this time, they were also kind of becoming more marketized. There's a quote from an article on essentialhospitals.org, which is a PAC for public hospitals in the U.S. At the same time, they remained committed to the mission of treating all, and they became ever more vulnerable in the marketplace. So really, now there's this consideration that has to be made about costs and income and revenue and stuff like that, which really didn't exist before. So now hospitals are becoming a place where their finances are becoming ever more important and really affecting the healthcare that they are able to provide.
Now, earlier you noted that some families could be bankrupted potentially by having a doctor attend a birth, which is why there was such an incentive to seek things like midwives and so forth. What was the other sort of big picture situation going on here in terms of how people paid for medical care?
Prior to this, like I said, physicians were kind of more rural. They were operating out of their houses or like very small practices, and they didn't charge that much money. And for what fees they did charge, people were able to barter or able to kind of have like an IOU sort of situation. It was just very informal, kind of an informal arrangement. But as these hospitals become more professionalized, physicians are becoming more attached to hospitals, they are able to charge more, and it's more of a formal situation. You're getting bills from a hospital versus just the friendly doctor down the street. And so as these medical costs went up, people had to figure out ways to pay for it. I found an article from the AMA, their Journal of Ethics, and they kind of talk about the history of the U.S. healthcare system, or as they called it, the U.S. healthcare non-system. So commercial insurance companies did not write health insurance policies in 1908. They saw no way to avoid the risks of adverse selection. Those who were sick would seek coverage, and those who were healthy would not, which I remember that talking point came up a lot in the Affordable Health Care Act as well, kind of these callbacks to history. And also moral hazard. Coverage would encourage the insured to seek unnecessary services. Again, that came up during the ACA debates. And these insurance companies had lacked the means to calculate risks accurately and set appropriate premiums. Also during this time, many European nations would adopt some form of compulsory national health insurance, but similar proposals in the U.S. were rejected because of lack of interest and resistance from physicians, which is kind of funny that this is an AMA article because they were leading the charge against a national health insurance program. So during the 1920s, the cost of medical care rose due to growing demand and higher quality standards for physicians and hospitals. Families had more money to spend, but less room in their homes to care for sick family members. Advances in medical technology, tougher licensing criteria, and the growing acceptance of medicine as a science led to the emergence of hospitals as credible centers for treatment. They were now modern scientific institutions that valued antiseptics and cleanliness and used medications for the relief of pain. When the American College of Surgeons was founded in 1913, it was the first body to accredit hospitals. Of the 692 hospitals examined in 1918, only 13% received accreditation. By 1932, the percentage had grown to 93% of the 1,600 hospitals surveyed. In 1929, the average American family had medical expenses about $103, which was roughly 5% of the average annual income of $1,916. Typically, 14% of these expenses were for hospital care. So in 1929, a group of Dallas school teachers contracted with Baylor University Hospital to receive up to 21 days of inpatient care a year for regular monthly payments of 50 cents. Similar prepaid service plans, many involving more than one hospital, were formed during the Depression years. While they gave consumers an affordable way to pay for inpatient care, their primary purpose was to assure hospitals a steady income stream during a period of declining revenues. By 1937, there were 26 such plans with more than 600,000 members total. These combined under the auspices of the American Hospital Association to form the Blue Cross Network of Plans, the first of which had been established in 1932 in Sacramento. The creation of these plans was facilitated by state legislation that allowed them to organize as nonprofit corporations, enjoy tax-exempt status, and avoid the onerous insurance regulations, particularly financial reserve requirements that applied to commercial insurers. Over the years, many legislative proposals for different approaches to health insurance were introduced and failed. In 1944, President Roosevelt asked Congress for an economic bill of rights that included a right to adequate medical care, but this request was never fulfilled. President Truman proposed a national health insurance program that would have created a system covering all Americans, but it was denounced by the AMA and called a communist plot by members of Congress. Same as it ever was, I guess. By 1950, national health care expenditures equaled 4.5% of the GNP and were continuing to rise. And that's kind of an overview of kind of the early history of insurance and how it kind of came to be. It's kind of scary to see how it started out really small and kind of more of a direct hospital arrangement. And then these third parties started coming in and kind of getting between patients and these hospitals and starting to form the insurance policies that exist in kind of a mutated form today.
Yeah. So like I said, this is sort of a key transitional period in the 1920s and then especially in the 1930s. And so a lot of the things that we experience and have to deal with now are emerging during this same period. And many of the same forces that conspired to kill the Sheppard-Towner Act, for however modest it was, and to kill off a lot of efforts to sort of expand the definition of healthcare and not just have everything be reliant on hospitals and doctors. All of this stuff is, you know, taking shape and emerging in the 1920s over the course of the 1920s and is still with us today. And that is one reason why this bill is able to be passed with bipartisan support and signed into law in 1921, 100 years ago this week. And then by 1929, they can't even get enough support to renew it for, you know, a couple more years. And that's sort of a remarkable sort of false start there, but it goes to show what sort of the broader picture was at the time. Rachel, did you have any other observations to make about any of this?
It's really interesting to note that any modest reform is going to get called a communist plot. But I guess we just have to kind of charge forward and like not be frightened by these slurs, I guess, and this slandering of communism.
Yeah, I mean, they were calling it a Bolshevik plot to train midwives on how to reduce infection rates during the home birth process.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So I think it's hard to fight against that. And I mean, it lasted for 8 years, which I guess is a modest victory. So it's interesting to see that this has been happening for a century now, and it's not going to go away. So I think we need to figure out ways to organize around this communist slur, I guess.
All right. Well, that's going to bring us to the end of this episode. As I said earlier, you can go to arsenalfordemocracy.com to check out the episode 400 notes to look at all these various articles that we read while researching this topic. And as a reminder, we've still got a Patreon. We're not doing the bonus episodes that we had been doing in the first half of the year once a week, as that was just logistically going to be very difficult for our schedules. But we have a $3 a month tier to just support the show. And, you know, we've been releasing over the past several weeks some of our favorite bonus episodes from earlier in the year to the main feed. So, you know, you're under no obligation to support the show because you're still going to get the regular free content, but that $3 a month tier would certainly be helpful to supporting the basic costs of the show and potentially expanding again in the future if we get some more subscribers. So that's patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, and that, you know, it's just a little bit of a help out to the show, which we, you know, have been doing now for 10 years, but basically as a labor of love and a hobby thing. but we really enjoy doing it. That's why we're up to episode 400 at this point. We've really definitely enjoyed doing a lot of the historical materialist and labor history and industrial history episodes over the past year and a half at this point. And we're definitely looking forward to continuing that. We've got an amazing array of fantastic topics in our planner pipeline coming up. And certainly, you know, we're almost to the end of 2021, which means wrapping up our 1921 and 1971 150-year look-backs, which means we'll be able to turn to 1922 and 1972 in just a few weeks and go over a lot of interesting things that came up then as well. So, Rachel, any other closing thoughts as we return now that I have successfully been reelected in a landslide victory to the city council?
Well, first of all, congratulations on your outstanding victory.
Thank you.
And also, I'm just really glad to be back. I am really enjoying these historical lookbacks and kind of tying what happened back then to the current political situation. And we can really pull some good lessons to learn and also what went right as well, and take that into the future.
All right. Well, Rachel, as always, thanks for joining me on these episodes.
Very glad to be here.